Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Happy Tuesday and welcome to another edition of Global Leader Radio. The purpose of our show is to engage in conversations that highlight our guests, educate our learning community, and add value to all who seek to optimize their learning acumen. So we achieve this purpose by providing our learning community with key takeaways, including resources and advice and tips that have led to the personal and professional success of our guests. And we've got a good one today. So today's conversation will highlight the role of leadership in one of the most dynamic aspects of today's business, the world of mergers and acquisitions. Now, this includes strategic decisions, valuation, negotiation, financing, and certainly post-merger integration and exiting the deal. And this is an area we teach in our Executive MBA program, and it is covered in greater detail in the Coles College M&A Academy. So with that overview, we welcome today's guest, Mr. Farrell Coppedge. So Farrell Coppedge serves as Western Region President of Regions Business Capital, and he's responsible for all lending and client administration in the Western sector. His experience spans over 35 years, both in leveraged buyouts and also doing restructurings and turnarounds in and outside of bankruptcy. So his focus has been in the middle market with companies ranging from the $50 million area to several billion in revenue size. And I'd love to have that middle market personally, but that's a different story. So both Farrell and his lovely wife, Elizabeth, co-founded Project 82 Kenya Incorporated in 2009. This is a 501c3 registered, non-denominational Christian charitable organization. And Project 82 partners with Kenyans to minister to the physical, spiritual, and educational needs of orphans. So he received both his Bachelor's of Business Administration and his Master's of Business Administration from Georgia State University, where he also lettered in basketball for 3 years. Now, I'm assuming that's three consecutive years.
It's actually not. There's a knee surgery in between.
There's a knee surgery. Okay. And we do share a love of basketball, as we were talking earlier. So Farrell has a unique leadership perspective as he's worked with highly trained and disciplined leaders, as well as entrepreneurs who have had less than a fully developed management and leadership skill set. So given that overview, I look forward to a stimulating discussion, so certainly no pressure, Farrell.
Right.
And I welcome Farrell Coppedge to today's edition of Global Leader Radio. So how are you today, sir?
Alvin, I'm doing great. I've been looking forward to conversing with you.
It's going to be fun. So to begin with, please tell us about Farrell Coppedge, starting with your original birthplace, home, a little bit about your work experience, and take us up to the present.
Well, I'm a native Atlantan, and there are not many of us in Atlanta that can say we're natives.
Correct.
Actually born and raised on the south side of Atlanta, went to the old Brown High School, and went to Georgia State, actually played basketball there, as you mentioned, and went directly into graduate school from undergraduate, and as I mentioned to you earlier, interrupted my plans to pursue a master's in health administration because I met Libby, who I've been married to now for 40 years, and switched over to the MBA program, finished that, and then started into a career in banking, not really with any explicit objectives to get into the M&A market. I've kind of backed into it during the early part of my career.
Okay, so continue to take us kind of up to what you're doing in terms of life from a larger perspective, certainly with Project 82. We're going to talk a little bit more about it at a high level. But I wanted to kind of touch on it at this point.
Absolutely. First of all, just to get at an issue, I'm a Christian. And so everybody has, I hope, some type of perspective in terms of how they see life. And that's kind of how I view it. And so while being dedicated to family, and my wife and I had four kids, kind of I view that as work hard, put your head down, educate the kids. And I basically did that for probably the first 30 years of my career. Spent a lot of time with my family, dedicated the weekends to my family, but was often on the road just keeping incredible hours during the course of the week. And I had the occasion to go to Kenya with some friends to consider setting up an economic development project with a community over there. And then that migrated into visiting a number of communities, seeing orphans, really being touched by that, and ultimately being called with some other people to start a 501c3 to try to connect U.S. churches to partner with Kenyans and Kenyan churches in educating, protecting, sustaining the physical environment, food, nutrition, health care for orphans. And we just recently opened up a home in Nairobi for babies that have been abandoned. And so we take them in from the police and stabilize them and try to get them adopted in the first 2 years. So that is, and again, it's interesting. Everything has a business model, and there's very much a business model associated to being a fiduciary and raising money and managing that money in an environment of accountability with transparency. And so my business skills, I think, have equipped me to do that with a reasonable degree of success.
It certainly sounds like it. So with regard to what you're doing with the with Regions Business Capital, can you tell us a little bit more about what the Western Region President does on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis?
Just about anything I want to, really, and I hope there are no Regions people listening to this. RBC is a leveraged lending platform, and again, as you mentioned, is focused on the middle market. And while what we predominantly do is finance leveraged buyouts and the whole M&A business, we also just finance middle market companies. Oftentimes, a family business will want to take out a dividend, and we'll do a recapitalization of the business. Sometimes companies need to go through bankruptcy to be restructured, and sometimes we'll do that type of business. But it is predominantly, again, middle market focused, and it's utilizing really two lending disciplines. One is asset-based lending, which is focusing on building your loan structures to finance the acquisition around a fairly detailed analysis of what the downside looks like, including a liquidation or a potential bankruptcy.
Worst-case analysis.
Right, and then building up your loan structure to protect you ideally in that downside scenario. So that's one discipline. Mm-hmm. The other is just basically lending off an analysis of the sustainable level of cash flows and lending the borrower a multiple of that cash flow in conjunction with a private equity firm that would put in a multiple of that EBITDA, if you will, as equity, and then potentially in some cases institutional lenders that would put in a piece in between, which we typically refer to as mezzanine.
Very good. So tell me a little bit about your work background, specifically your perspectives on the mergers and acquisitions market.
Well, I really come at it from two perspectives. I've been doing it. I've been involved in this line of business really actively since 1980, and I've really watched the middle market leveraged lending business grow up. I won't say I watched it be birthed, but back when I started doing this in the middle market, there was not a large private equity community. A lot of the leverage buyouts were actually called bootstrap acquisitions, and the capital structures largely consisted of the senior lender, the bank, the trade creditors that supplied the product, and a nominal amount of equity from the entrepreneurs, which we often refer to as sweat equity.
Okay.
And watched the market start that way back then because there was not enough capital really being attracted to this segment. The multiples, the purchase price multiples, were lower. The structures are more conservative, but as more private equity was raised and really proliferated to the extent that it exists today, the structures have become more complicated. The market has gone from being domestic to global.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the capital structures are now supplemented with not only senior debt, but institutional debt capital market products, which again is a market that has grown up around the around this industry.
Interesting. And you've been doing this before 1980, or
I started actually in 1980, being predominantly focused on mostly financing leveraged buyouts.
Leveraged buyouts. Okay, yeah. Got it. So tell us a little bit about the primary phases of an M&A transaction, and what are some of the leadership challenges you've noticed in each one of those phases.
Well, it begins with raising, you know, if you're a private equity firm, it begins with raising capital. But I'll just look at this from the perspective of being a lender.
Mm-hmm.
The phases are typically if there is a good company that's for sale, there are going to be many people looking at it.
Yes.
So there's a lots of dog and ponies on the front end, and there is lots of interaction between the management team that is incumbent with the company and the private equity firm or the investor. So there's great opportunity for sharing the philosophies of the respective parties. There's also a lot of spin that occurs in that environment, and there's a lot of selling. And so from a leadership perspective, you know, you see some masters of that process who do a wonderful job of not getting out over their skis, so to speak, overselling who they are, remembering that one day they may be partners for this management team, and what they say is, you know, is their bond. So you have that very interactive courting process. And then you have the process of when a buyer has been awarded the business and they have to go out and raise the financing. They have to interact with their creditors, with various constituencies, including going out oftentimes and meeting the customers and the trade creditors of the target company. They have to close the transaction, and they have to, as an investor, begin to interact with the employees and with the management team. And again, I'm looking at this from the perspective predominantly of the model where a private equity firm buys a company. It could be an entrepreneur, but there is an owner.
Correct.
And that owner typically sees the wisdom of involving the management team in the equity structure. So the management team will have a minority interest. But you have this whole process of bonding, communications, the collaboration on developing business plans. And, again, there are so many critical communications in that process because you're basically establishing kind of the bonds of trust. You are really trying to sort out the compatibility of your philosophies, not just along the lines of the core business, but your management philosophies, your compensation philosophies, how you incent people. So, I mean, it's a whole myriad of leadership and management interactions that occur in that phase. And then so as you move to the next phase, you basically may be integrating a business, you may be executing a business plan that could involve closing plants, it could involve expanding internationally. There's a whole host of things there. And then the last phase is the exit, and that assumes everything works out. Oftentimes it doesn't, and then there's a whole different phase of leadership associated with kind of riding the ship when sometimes things don't work out.
So what is the percentage of M&A deals that actually work out versus those that fail?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I should.
Okay.
I don't. You know, generally, the majority of them work out at some level. There are many very, very good companies, and we saw this in the Great Recession. We've seen it in every economic downturn where you have very fundamentally sound businesses that are over-levered. Ergo, the business may not work out in that it may not generate sufficient cash flow to service all of its capital structure, but it may then find itself in a bankruptcy restructuring or maybe an out-of-court restructuring where some of the debt is converted to equity. You still have a fundamentally sound business. You just have too much leverage.
Right, okay.
And so
it just can't sustain itself.
Obviously. It can't sustain itself, but in most cases, if the company's large enough, and at the end of the day, if it has a good value proposition with its customer, it'll continue, but it may have a different set of stockholders, and it may have to go through a restructuring.
And then the other piece of that, too, that it needs to have good management.
Absolutely.
As well, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And as you and I have talked in other conversations before, good management is contextual. And, you know, you may have the right management to grow a business, to expand it, but if the company does not succeed, it may take another management team or another leader to lead it through a restructuring.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that. I found that to be pretty fascinating in having that offline conversation with you, Farrell. The whole notion that one leader is rarely good enough for all the different phases of an M&A transaction or the various phases of what could happen in an M&A transaction and deals. And that's really akin to what happens in normal business, right?
Right.
From a normal life cycle of a business, starting off the business, and you've got these entrepreneurial folks who ideate well, and sometimes they can get it financed, sometimes they can't. Then you move into the perhaps the more mature phase where they can maintain it and add on various other products, services, and keep it going. And then you've got those on the back end that need to be able to sell this particular structure and be able to get the worth out of it or disaggregate it and sell its associated parts.
Right.
So
right.
Talk a little bit about that for us.
Well, you covered a lot just with that overview. Let me see if I can piecemeal it. When things don't work out, whatever the business model is, when things don't work out, when the business model has to be changed, somebody has not performed, somebody's philosophies have not aligned with the opportunity, something has gone wrong. So guess what? Human egos all of a sudden are center stage. And you have leaders that need to look at, you know, the organizational dynamic, whatever it is. It's not performing well. It's not aligned. You always have some people that want to stay the course, and even if it goes right off the cliff, and you have
they don't
others,
want to give it up.
You have others that don't. So you have a leadership dynamic. We like to refer to that phase as, you know, looking for the adult in the room, somebody that can come in and get the fighting children to see the bigger picture, the greater good. Oftentimes, the entrepreneur that birthed the idea doesn't have a fully developed appreciation for the importance of liquidity and capital. And they will have to give up in a distressed situation, maybe the greatest product opportunity or the greatest marketing initiative they've ever thought of because they simply don't have the capital. Oftentimes in leverage deals, and these are not investment grade deals, these are leverage transactions, you oftentimes have to fall back to spring forward. And so the leader has to come in and certainly has to have a broad-based competency that all the constituencies understand that this person has a degree of credibility. They know what they're talking about. But they also have to have the powers of persuasion to articulate their position, to back it up, to persuade people, to bring the constituencies together. They have to have the courage to make changes when they need to be made. And in a leverage environment, the leverage takes away a lot of the time that might normally exist to fix a problem. I mean, leverage forecloses opportunity because the bank always gets paid. You have the payment next month. And so you have to sometimes make very, very difficult decisions to exit a business, close a plant, and simply when you cannot bring people, together to see that proper course forward, you oftentimes have to make management changes. And it's very difficult process to maneuver through a restructuring. You asked a question earlier, how many leverage buyouts work? And I don't know the answer to that. Most of them do.
Some
maybe with a different capital structure, but ultimately, there's a deal that works, a company that's viable. Most restructurings, particularly where there are radical changes that have to be made to management, many of those don't work out. And particularly those that do not have a capital structure that can be restructured in bankruptcy. If it's a larger company and there's high-yield bonds below you, there's some type of debt capital market product that can convert its debt to equity in a bankruptcy, those type of deals have a greater chance of being restructured in bankruptcy. But the smaller companies that consist really of the senior debt and the trade, there's nothing to restructure.
Understood.
So you fix those, they get fixed quickly, or in many cases, they liquidate.
And in those cases is when leadership really shows forth even more, right?
Yeah.
It's more important then.
Yeah. You're really that is where the investors, the private equity firm, if they have not built a foundation of trust, they're in big trouble. They're going to lose their equity investment because people in that environment, it really takes a leader to turn a business around.
Interesting.
When people are, show up every day at work and they're not sure if they're going to have a job, these are people that have families, they have kids in school, they may be buying a house.
They have debt structures.
They're dealing with life. They may have, yeah. I mean, they really, the job is everything. So if there is uncertainty about the viability of the business, it is, human dynamics just totally get out of control. So
interesting.
Leaders achieve turnarounds. Mm-hmm. Managers manage business, but leaders, if you turn around a business, I'll be able to find leaders. And good leaders basically surround themselves with developing leaders. They're always developing leaders. They're always making sure that they have a team of good leaders. But anytime you see a turnaround, the more difficult the case may be, the more you're going to find exceptional leadership. Somebody trusted somebody's idea to go from point A to point B when all they really had to rely on was the leader's word or the leader's representation. They couldn't necessarily see their way through the forest.
So it doesn't really matter if it's M&A, leverage buyouts, or basketball. Leaders right. always achieve turnarounds.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so there's very few head coaches in basketball, for example, in sports we love,
yeah.
where they can come in and turn around a whole situation and then are happy with it all the way through, right? Because you've seen the Nick Sabans even in football. He loves to start a program, but after a few years, or at least in the past, after a few years, he's moved on. I think that may have changed now.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you pay somebody enough money, they'll stay. And I think Nick Saban is going to be at Alabama a long time. They love him there. He already has his own statue. I mean, Bear Bryant, it took forever for him to get his, but, I mean, Saban already has his. I think one reason we're all fascinated by athletics is it's a microcosm of life. You see all of the dynamics in a compressed time frame. You see the importance of teamwork. And in a business, you may spend years developing teamwork and camaraderie, where a coach may achieve it, you know, between October the 15th when the season starts and when March comes around. Much more difficult thing to do, but it's still the same dynamic of getting people to trust and to understand the power of many versus the power of one. It's a fascinating thing, but what scrambles my brain looking at college athletics right now is really the particularly with basketball, it's where you come in as a freshman and then you're a lottery pick. I don't know how in the world coaches consistently pull off building a team with that dynamic.
Well, one of them that has been very successful, as you know, has been John Calipari
right.
at Kentucky. The
didn't,
one and done
didn't do it this year.
Yeah, couldn't pull it off this year, but he's got the number one class or one of the top five classes coming in for this next one.
Yeah.
But we're talking with Farrell Coppedge, and he serves as the Western Region President of Regions Business Capital, and he's responsible for all lending and client administration in the Western sector. With regard to the character traits you talked about earlier, you talked about trust and respect and integrity. So how does that play into the effectiveness of leaders? I know you touched on the edges of it, mm-hmm. and you're going to zero in a little bit more as we talk, even as we move through here. But I recall that Tuckman's model of teaming, the forming, the storming, the performing, and the norming, all of those various models are overlaid, and you can't have all of that stuff to move forward. You can have business move forward. You can have leadership without actually the foundation of trust.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's the foundation. If the foundation's not there, then, it's a weak structure. And I have observed more bad leaders in my business career than I have good leaders. One of the perspectives you have as a lender, and particularly at my age, I've looked at thousands of transactions and financed many, many businesses over the years, but I have interacted more with, let's just say, less than excellent leaders than I have excellent leaders. And more times than not, it's the it's a lack of the kind of the base character traits that undoes or is the undoing of some of the leaders. So to me, that is a given. But in the world of leveraged buyouts, there are lots of very, very intelligent people. I'm on the periphery, and I'm not one of them. Mm-hmm. But I get to observe, and I can recognize intelligence when I see it. And there are lots of very, very intelligent people. But competency only gets you so far. And so when you don't have that foundation of trust, integrity, I mean, we talked about communications earlier. I mean, it's more than communicating the message. I got to believe it.
Right.
Communicate the message, you can articulate it, but do I believe the communicator? Do I believe the message? And when that whole fabric of trust starts to fray, it adversely impacts everything. There are lots of other important attributes, but if they're not overlaid with strong character, then you're going to have problems. And it may not be on a particular deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, a leveraged buyout business, private equity firms raise lots of money. They right. raise it to invest it. They have a period of time to invest it. It's a very, very competitive marketplace. And so they're going to get the money out.
Right.
And they're going to invest it. And sometimes, you know, they'll own a company 2, 3, 4 years and flip it.
Mm-hmm.
So the company may do great. The shareholders may do well. The private equity investors may do well. Doesn't mean necessarily that the leaders within that business are excellent. They may be competent. But, again, they didn't encounter the challenges of a turnaround. They didn't encounter the challenges of a global expansion or something else that would stretch them to the point where they, you know, they've got to rely more on that base foundation.
Well, that's a great point. So you brought up global. And so with regard to the things we've just talked about, have you noticed any difference between global or domestic with regard to the need for trust? And it depends on the culture. Is it still the same in China or in India or any place in Asia or any place else beyond our continent as whether or not this trust factor is important? I mean,
you know, it's back to, you know, kind of the basic communication model. I have a message. I'm sending the message. There are filters. You need to have a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
And at every phase, there is a cultural filter that's incredible. And so the answer is
that's an additional filter.
It's an additional filter that really kind of just garbles everything else. So it is from my limited experience. And when I was at Bank of America, I was involved in a supply chain business and spent some time in China.
Okay.
And also with Project 82, I'm involved in Africa and I've done business with private equity firms out of India. But there is always a cultural filter. Communications are always challenging. And when they matter the most, and that's when there's trust involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're just communicating an idea around a product or a service or a strategy, we can typically get on the same page. But when trust is called into question, when emotions rise, when all those other dynamics of relationships occur, you can get your cart in the ditch in a hurry. And give you an example. In Africa, there are significant cultural differences, and one in particular is time has very little authority in the African culture, and I'm generalizing grossly here, but any of my African friends out there, particularly my Kenyan friends, will know exactly what I'm talking about. Kenyans say, you know, Americans have watches, but they don't have time. And you know, we showed up today, and you asked me to be here at 2 o'clock, and everything started at 2:30, and to be here at 2:35 would have been a problem. I have been to weddings in Africa that were supposed to start at noon that didn't start until 4, and nobody was upset. Everybody was having an incredible time, but there's just not this pressure around time. So time doesn't have authority. So if you're going to have a business meeting with someone in Nairobi and you set it up for noon, it may happen at 2 or 3. Now, relationships are of paramount importance in that culture. So if on the way to lunch you see a friend or a member of family, you are not going to hesitate to stop and spend time with them because that's a gift that you have the opportunity to relate. So you have this whole dynamic going on. That's a fairly extreme example, but I can tell you with the business interactions that I've had in some of the other places I've mentioned, there are still cultural impediments to communicating effectively, particularly when it matters, when there's stress, when there's a dynamic that you're trying to really accomplish something important.
So is it fair to say that with regard to the cultural filter, that additional filter, relationship, it begins with relationship?
Yes. Yes, but – you know, there's a generational thing. And, you know, I text. I don't like it. not only just in terms of, but there is I'm afraid the possibility that there is a distorted view of communications that's evolving.
Mm-hmm.
We're blessed to have incredible ways with technology to communicate. Can Skype with my friends in Africa, can, you know, all of that's wonderful, but there are certain communications that only should take place face-to-face because part of the feedback loop is your nonverbals.
Okay.
And if I can't see those.
Exactly right.
If I can't see those, then I can't tell you how many times I have unwisely joked or kidded with somebody on a conference call and found out later that I had offended them, and everybody on my side of the call was laughing, and everybody on their side. So you just – communications have to be elevated in terms of how very important the nuances of communications are when you're dealing any time where you're separated. It could be anywhere within this country, but particularly when you are going cross-cultural in another country.
And, Farrell, thank you for that point. What's fascinating is that you have reiterated the same things we tell people, and we'll be telling them this coming Saturday at the information session for our program. What we tell people is that you can only go so high with a functional, foundational leadership, understanding on a functional perspective. You got to have leadership to move even past that, because mm-hmm. you've got to be able to influence people. You got to be able to help people to understand how to bond. You've got to communicate. You've got to collaborate. They've got to be these incentives. And so we put those, that functional side together with the interpersonal side, and come up with a very interesting mix and a way to do that through the foundation of teaming.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we deliver our program. We're one of the few in the world that do it the way we do. And certainly no one in Metro Atlanta can touch us with regard to that. But it's not an easy process.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at leadership that works, is it ever easy?
No. Okay. No, it never is.
There you go.
You know, and I have developed I won't say it's a refined, but for me anyway, a more refined understanding of leadership over the years. And it used to be all about charisma.
Mm.
It was about the leader that could stand up and inspire and just, you know, make motivate, you want to just, you know, get out of the – but Colin Powell's, I forget how he said it, but he said perpetual optimism is a force multiplier. And that's true. I mean, you have somebody with a positive attitude that literally is totally committed. That's wonderful. But if you don't have all those other attributes around it, then that person will get, as we say, out over their skis, and they'll burn up pretty quickly. Now, when I see that perpetual optimism with competency and with someone like General Powell, you take that, and I mean, it's powerful. That's
yes.
one of those powerful leaders you never forget. And one of the things that inspires you is that perpetual optimism, and it does motivate you tremendously. But it's not just about the charisma and the positive attitude. That only gets you so far.
Yeah, it's not enough. You've got to have that credibility too, right? So that when you
right.
speak, people actually know that you're
right.
talking. You know what you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know, I've also seen the merger and acquisition business on the other side. You know, banking has been consolidating the entire time that I've been in the industry. So I've been through 5 mergers, and have been involved in shutting down businesses, selling businesses, and. You know, I've seen it from that side, and it is very, very hard. I have a great appreciation for the dynamic that I see in the mergers and acquisition business because of some of the times I've had to stand up in front of people and want to speak truthfully but really not have a whole lot positive to say and really to lead people in terms of managing their expectations to the possibility of a hard landing.
So you're specifically talking about the role of leadership when an M&A deal doesn't work out and turns into a crisis, potential
yeah.
Bankruptcy, default with lenders, et cetera,
yep.
right?
Yep. Yeah, that is perhaps the most one of the most challenging environments for a leader to operate in. And as I said earlier, oftentimes because the bar is so high and it is such a specific skill set, oftentimes you will see private equity firms fire the incumbent management, bring in a turnaround consultant, or bring in a CEO that has experience in doing turnarounds.
Okay.
And to do it successfully, again, you have to have competency. You have to have the right plan, but you are going to, almost in every case, probably be doing layoffs. You're going to be doing plant closures. You may be reassessing the profitability of your customer relationships, and there may be some customers you're doing lots of revenue with, but you're not making any money. So there's a whole process of refining the business model and invariably touching many constituencies with change, and oftentimes it's change that, you know, has a negative consequence personally.
So you're affecting quite a few lives.
Absolutely.
And you can develop a nickname.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Chainsaw.
Yes, right.
Yeah. I have, unfortunately, in my business career, I've had been through situations where there have been suicides in the context of plant closures, and it's really horrific. I tell you what, the leaders that I admire the most and I think perform best recognize they're committed to people. Mm-hmm. They're people. They're people focused, and they care about people, and they identify with people, and they can feel their pain. They simply are looking at maybe 5,000 people that are employees and saying, okay, I care enough that 3,000, only 3,000 of y'all are going to end up with a job.
Right.
But 2,000, they still feel the pain of the 2,000 that have to be because of outsourcing, because of offshoring, or whatever the global economy often demands. They're trying to save a business and as many employees as possible. But if they simply try to manage their emotions by being distant and uncaring or whatever, I mean, people can figure that out in a hurry. And they're not going to follow a leader like that.
Yeah, so there has to be a measure of empathy there as well.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Great points. So, Cobbage, when you analyze a deal, what are some of the clues that suggest a lack of leadership in your mind? I mean, how do you know when you're looking at a deal or you're looking at a situation that leadership is at the heart of it? Do you get an intuitive feeling, something in your gut, or is there something concrete you can kind of look at and start analyzing?
Well, the underwriting process of a deal has many dimensions, and I typically get involved. I'm involved in the approval process, but I'm typically involved when I meet management. I oftentimes like to meet with the senior leader one-on-one or in a small group. And I start really with just I am fascinated by strategy. I want to hear what the strategy is. I want to understand why they have the strategy. I usually talk about how do you compensate? How are you going to reward your management team? How are you going to reward your employees? I'm very big on incentive systems, and I've been around enough of them to know that you get the behavior you incent. It's oftentimes different than what you think. But I'm a big believer in sharing the wealth and creating a dynamic where people can own a part of the bottom line and can get compensated that way. So I spend a lot of time just trying, just like we're doing right now, just talking. Tell me what you're thinking. Tell me, and you will invariably get into system to a conversation about value systems, about how people see the business, how people see the customers.
How to see the employees.
How they see the employees, all the constituencies. I love to lend money to people that want to pay everybody back, that genuinely want to pay everybody back, because I was raised that way. I mean, if my dad dearly departed, but, he was the type of guy, and he was a product of the Depression, but if he owed somebody money, I mean, bankruptcy was, he never had any finance, but he'd pay you back.
That's spend right.
The rest. And so it's amazing how many people today, really deep down inside, want to pay you back.
Really?
They want to pay you back, but at the end of the day, it's if things don't work out, that's the risk of the business.
Right,
and
right.
So if they can restructure you in bankruptcy or somewhere else, then they'll walk away from their obligations. There are people out there like that. They're private equity firms whose value systems we don't line up well with.
Interesting. So the ripple effect of great leadership in M&A space has an impact on the local and the state and the national economy, right?
Absolutely.
So M&A is huge. I mean, it's a really big deal.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And I hope that we'll see very soon the full force of hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions, sitting on the sideline right now of capital that's been raised. That just, and it is very, very close to, I think, being deployed. And hopefully the next leg of the economy up will be private equity, really kicking in, and the M&A business really kicking in big time, because there's an enormous amount of capital that's sitting on the sidelines right now. And certainly
that money needs to be put to work.
It needs to be put to work, and they're just, there are millions of jobs wrapped up in that happening.
Yeah, that's important. So what are some of the attributes that can be the Achilles heel to leaders?
I think we've touched on some of them.
Especially when they're overused, correct?
Yeah, I think, again, we have a tendency to label synonymously the person that's in charge as a leader. And so oftentimes they're just the manager. They're the person in charge, but they're not the leader.
Okay.
But you know, self-awareness is something that's very important. You don't have to, you know, you have to have a level of competency that's typically multidimensional. You don't have to be a finance MBA, but you need to understand finance. You need to understand the P&L. You need to understand cash flow. You need to understand liquidity. You need to understand, you know, the lending markets. You don't need to be a product development specialist, but you need to understand your product. You need to understand what need it's meeting, how the product differentiates, the value proposition. You need to know all of that. And quite frankly, business is hyper-competitive right now. I mean, there's a lot of excellence out there. And so if you can't do it at an adequate level, then find somebody that can. I mean, you need to be aware. A leader needs to be aware of when they don't need to be standing up in front of a group, but somebody else does. So when they need to be leveraging part of their management team or another leader, when they need – I mean, the ultimate incredible leader are those that basically – grow a business that, you know, makes them obsolete.
Right.
So this whole area of self-awareness is huge, and you see it all the time where people just simply, it's like, please sit down. This is not your arena. You see it in the turnaround business where the entrepreneur, you know, the business wouldn't exist but for the entrepreneur, but you can get into some problem loan situations where simply they're not the right people to be at the table. So self-awareness is huge. It'd probably be my number one. And then, you know, the whole integrity platform. Take any of those attributes, those character attributes, and they do cause people problems just universally across the board. I mean, you know, just whatever it is that makes me not trust you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to start hedging my – I'm going to – whatever you say, I'm going to start handicapping it. You know, just a little bit, ever so much. And so after a while, it's like I just don't trust my leader.
Wow. Yeah. So how would you describe your leadership style?
You know, I didn't know you were going to ask me that. And I can wander forever, probably never answer your question. You know, I believe in empowering people. I mean, I it's kind of the golden rule of management, doing to others as you'd like to be done unto you. And I like to develop people. I like to see people develop. I know that is kind of an art in terms of proper training and giving people more responsibility, not enough to fall and hurt themselves or destroy the organization, but enough to develop, to make some mistakes. I believe that, you know, in a management style that allows non-critical, non-terminal mistakes, not repeat offenders.
Right.
But I believe you learn from making mistakes, and you've got to create an environment where there's trust to where people know that there will be mistakes. You know, you're going to have an environment of excellence, so you're not going to encourage, you know, we'll dust yourself up 100 times and dust yourself off 100 times and keep coming back. That's not practical, but I believe in you know, yeah, that's kind of, you know, it, to me, it's all, I believe in, I came up during the world in search of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I believe in just little things like, you know, management by wandering around. I believe leaders can stay in touch. I think, you know, you can undermine the hierarchy of an organization by overstepping the bounds of that. But I think you can have a rapport and a connection with the employees that can allow you to see things in a non-threatening way to your management team where they don't feel like you're being undermined.
Mm-hmm. And so, they can tell you more. You can learn more in those situations
absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer in accountability. I just think at the end of the day, you've got to have an environment where you can hear all the bad news that's out there, including – things that relate to the ineffective parts of your management and leadership style. And I was raised in an organization where we used to call them personnel audits, and we had one of the first, you know, in our business kind of national platforms, and in a decentralized model, you've got to have some way of seeing what you can't see. And so we set up a system of what we call personnel audits, where there were, you know, very elaborate, in-depth Q&As that all the employees filled out once a year, including, you know, critiquing, you know, the openness of communications, the fairness of evaluations, the existence of performance evaluations. One of the biggest tricks in the world is a lot of people think there's a lot of performance evaluation going on. You'd be amazed how little quality development of personnel and performance evaluation occurs in the business world, even with the largest organizations. But, you know, and so that feedback comes back to you, and you first of all create an environment where it's not threatening and people can give you honest feedback. But I lived in that type of environment for 20 years where you didn't necessarily look forward to reading the feedback of your region, division, or whatever, but you desperately needed that information to make mid-course corrections, to stay connected. You know, you've got to stay connected. Leaders can absolutely get too far ahead of the pack and can isolate themselves very, very easily.
Understood. And I appreciate you for indulging us with that response. Now, let me ask you a question offline. There's only just you, I, and Kevin in here with a few million people listening. Nobody else will ever know. Yeah. So did you secretly ever want to become a coach?
Not really. I had some great coaches. And again, like managers and leaders, you observe, I had some coaches that weren't so great. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of admiration for coaching, but it is
it's a tough job. Huh?
Well, the fact that you've got to keep rebuilding the team on such a short cycle, I just think it's hard to do that. Yeah. It's hard to build a team on a 9-month cycle, and then the next year you do it all over again with a different. You know, coaches that really do it well are exceptional leaders.
Yeah,
exceptional leaders.
There's some gene in their DNA, perhaps that helps them or something. I don't know what it is, but how does Farrell Coppish define leadership, both personally and professionally?
Personally, it's just you have to be yourself. I mean, I don't believe you can fool anybody for very long, and I don't think you should try. And I think you have to be comfortable with who you are. Mm-hmm. And, I've always been motivated to continue learning and to create learning environments in organizations where I have been able to do that. But I am a work in process. I'm just a work in process. I think the first time you and I spoke, I was telling you when I was in graduate school, I did a paper on – I was fascinated, in athletics and motivation, just, you know, the we've all seen the gifted athlete that's not motivated.
Right.
That is just, why in the world, gosh, if I had that. And then you've seen the overachiever. And so I did a paper and a study actually in conjunction with several of the old banks, old First Atlanta Bank and Trust Company of Georgia, looking at Hertzberg's maintenance motivational model and Maslow's need hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Very elementary, simple, probably be embarrassed to read it now, but but really fascinated with motivation. And so a part of my whole perspective on working with people is how can I create an environment and a relationship with you to help you maximize your potential. And first of all, help you see that you have unlimited potential.
Yeah.
And so I've always approached all of my relationships that way. I'm big on, I have very strong nonverbals. You know that from looking at me. I can't see it. Somebody told me early on that I should have rearview mirrors mounted on the side of my head so I could see what I was communicating to people across the table. And so I have this whole idea of self-awareness, not that I'm good at it, but people helped me early in my career understand kind of how the importance of how you're perceived and the effectiveness, and really being a student of the nuance of communication. You know, so often, communications are not highly refined. I can tell you what something is. I can ask you all the you know, feedback questions. You understand? Tell me what I just said. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes I can draw it even tighter by saying what I don't mean. Now, don't misunderstand. Here are all the things I don't mean by just what I said. Let's really narrow it.
Yeah.
And so
that's truly a sophisticated model doing that as well, right?
It is, and it really, you know, the more examples you have, a lot of my business career has been managing offices where I'm not in physical. Now, you know, go back to literally teleconferencing in the 90s, mm-hmm. you know, with a 15-second time delay. But I have an awareness, again, just through experience of how difficult it is, but also how much time you spend clarifying communications. And if you could do a better job of getting it right the first time. Now, in many cases, I have a 10-minute conversation I need to have with a manager that would be a lot easier to pick up the phone and do by phone, but it's too high risk.
Okay.
So you get on a plane and you go sit down.
Sit down with it.
Yeah, and you, in essence, it may be 10 minutes, but you're going to save yourself so much grief by doing it face-to-face. People appreciate it. Plus, they can see and kind of sense the sincerity of the message as well. So, I mean, you know, back to the management style, I read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so, like I said, I'm a work in process, but I am very much, I'm pretty transparent, been criticized more often of sharing too much rather than too little, got myself into trouble sometimes doing that, but that's my orientation. And I love, and maybe some of this is the athletics, I love to see the beauty of team. I love to see people develop. I love to see people grow up. I love to see people, quite frankly, that I haven't given up on, but mm-hmm. but really in a sense from a business standpoint, I had to give up on them. See them 10 years later in their business career, and they're doing fabulous. I love to see that.
Fantastic.
Even when I was an impediment to it.
Yeah, yeah. And so I tell you, you're a pretty humble guy, which is what I always liked about you from the first time we met in the M&A Academy, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And so your bio shows that you've given quite a bit of your time and talent, as we spoke about earlier, in a particularly big way, especially mm-hmm. in Kenya.
Yeah.
So can you talk about the importance of the global community when leaders give back?
Yeah, I don't want to sound trite, but I really do believe we're a community of relationships. I mean, you know, I have so much. You talk about giving, you know, that's what stumps me. I'm giving back, but I'm getting so much more than I'm giving. I really do believe the gift is greater for the
giver than the receiver.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would love to debate that at length with anybody that has a different view, and I can get into the nuance of that. But it is just so fascinating to realize that whatever you have, whatever gifts you've been given, that you can share that, and it's really a privilege to be able to do it. Like I said, I backed into Africa. It was not a deliberate, intentional thing that my wife and I and some other people were going to do. But now that I'm involved in it, I realize that, you know, I'm equipped to do it with some level of skill.
Mm-hmm.
There are significant challenges in just managing the flow of money. We're a fiduciary, so we have to do it with excellence. We have audited financial statements. We have third-party accreditation of the ECFA regarding financial accountability. So we're serious about doing it the right way. But again, it's a skill set, having done international business, that I understand and other people around me understand. So I can bring other people. But, you know, whether it's working with whether it's mentoring youth, mm-hmm. whether it's working with the homeless, whether or not, whatever it is, I mean, the joy of life comes from that. I mean, you know, if you're bored, you know, then get out of yourself and give some of yourself away. I mean, that to me is, I mean, that's good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I would totally agree with you. And when you look across leadership and don't see people giving back mm-hmm. or getting involved in the community, there tends to be perhaps things that make me look twice.
Exactly. Exactly. No. Exactly.
So with regard to leadership and leadership styles, who have you admired that has impacted your leadership style? I heard you mention Colin Powell earlier. and perhaps some of the things he said that has impacted you, but I'm certain that there are.
Yeah, there isn't. I mean, you know, goodness gracious, a war is pretty serious, and I think the great military leaders really understand something we never can, and that is what it's like to talk to a parent of someone who's died in the service of the country. And so when you see people, and I've had the opportunity to hear Colin Powell speak a couple of times, but I certainly admire him. He's he's a real deal, I can't remember too many of his leadership principles other than the one about not getting your ego wrapped up too much in what you're doing, so when you fail, you know, you're not devastated. And I love the one about this sounds so military, but perpetual optimism is a force multiplier. And but you know, again, you put that attribute on anybody else other than someone like Colin Powell, and so often than not, it's going to be a flash in the pan. It's going to be somebody that. You know, I've just taken, you know, I kind of pick and choose and see things in a number of different leaders that do things well. But, you know, we're all human, and most of the people that I've worked with occasionally will disappoint you as well. So it's I've seen people have the capacity to take incredible technical knowledge. And they know they're so competent with the technical knowledge that they can make it simple and convincing, and they can move the needle with people's, you know, believing in them. And you're just amazed how in the world can somebody take something this complicated with this many dimensions and just do what they just did, and you're just in awe. And then in other cases, you know, you may hear a leader stumble through the presentation of a plan, inarticulate, not convincing at all in their style, but based on who they are and their character, you just are, you know, they might as well, you know, have just delivered the greatest speech in the world, not because of the form, but because of the content and just the fact that you believe it. Mm. So, you know, I pick and choose. You know, a name you may remember, but most other people on this probably, you know, Lee Iacocca.
Yes.
You know, Chrysler. I mean,
that was a big turnaround.
That was a huge turnaround. And again, his perpetual optimism was a force multiplier. And,
yeah.
And he had to deal with lots of constituencies, from the government to creditors to, you know, an unbelieving public that didn't want to buy the car, that felt they were, you know, the Chrysler was going to be in bankruptcy. So. Nobody in particular, but just across the board, a number of people.
Well, I tell you what, it sounds as though you've developed a framework, and even though you perhaps don't have it listed in an ABCD type of format, one of the things you said earlier in our conversation was that leaders achieve turnarounds.
Yeah.
And so here you are, and one of the icons you pointed to is Lee Iacocca, who's achieved one heck of a turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also believe that the military and people in finance and M&A share a lot of qualities, because sometimes, you know, when you look at mergers and acquisitions, it shouldn't be that way, but sometimes it is like a mini war.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a lot of things that have to be sifted out, and sometimes there is collateral damage. So there's a lot of similarities in my mind when I think about the two, but that's a different story perhaps for a different day.
I'll tell you this. Being in the Southeast in my business career, I have watched the dismantling of the U.S. textile industry and large parts of the furniture industry. And, you know, some notable names that were involved in the restructurings and of those industries are, you know, Wilbur Ross and Carl Icahn, and, you know, a lot of names that are familiar to us in this part of the country, the West Point, you know, Pepperells. And you know, the business proposition there was to dismantle, you know, an industry where the global economy just, you know, made it more economically feasible to manufacture the product somewhere else. They didn't write the rules, and again, I'm not condoning some of the stuff that was done, but I mean, you know, you talk about some of the infrastructures of plants across the Southeast. I mean, there were whole, you know, areas of states where the unemployment rate. I mean, you just, you know, everybody, they were just like, you know, closing plants left and right, and it wasn't like everybody wanted to stand up and cheer, but their business model. They were investing for their investor, and they were accomplishing that objective to realize a return on the invested capital. And unfortunately, in many cases, it involved dismantling, you know, entire industries that have been the bedrock of this country for centuries.
And it's interesting how that happens, right? You know, you look at it at a micro level of individuals, and then you start moving up the chain toward the macro level. You've got neighborhoods, and then you've got communities, and then you've got cities, and then next thing you know, you've got industries that have somehow sometimes evaporated and moved forward.
Exactly.
You know, so, Farrell, what do you wish you knew about leadership much earlier in life? And you're still a fairly young guy. I'm sorry, I don't mean to suggest that you're not.
I'm glad. Yeah, this is radio, right? Everybody out there believes you. No. You know, I probably wish I knew more about just the power of leadership, the power of effective leadership. You know, I kind of, one of my definitions is really just very simply, you know, moving non-coercively a group of people from one point to the other.
Okay.
And the non-coercively, because I started early in my career. I worked at Ford for 5 years, and this was back during a period of a significant retooling of the whole automotive industry back in the late 70s. And I went to management training seminars there, and I would have very intelligent people talk about the need to have a Theory X manager come in to do a turnaround, shut it down, but basically then get them out of the way because there's no way they could grow and lead the new business.
Mm-hmm. And required a Theory Y manager.
Yeah, place them with Theory Y, a very deliberate Theory X, Theory Y type of approach. And, I mean, just the power of leadership. I think the other thing is understanding, this is so important, you know, every leader, every manager should be a student of communications. I mean, that is something that is just so fundamental, and it is so radically more complex than people realize.
Okay.
And I have a tendency now just to wander around every time I'm dealing with an issue to say, okay, what's the genesis of this problem? Do we have a bad strategy, or do people just not understand it? I mean, you literally, some people think you can say thing one time. There's an old Wall Street Journal full-page advertisement. I forget the name of the vendor. Irish setters, and I don't want to offend anybody, but Irish setters are supposedly known for not being very bright. And this full-page Wall Street Journal advertisement is nothing but probably about 50 or 100 frames of an Irish setter standing with one notation below it that says sit.
Hmm.
The next one says sit. Sit, 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 all the way down the page. The dog finally sits and says, good dog, and it says, you know, some messages to be understood have to be repeated 100 times. So really the understanding of communication is until that message has been acted on, you cannot make the assumption it's understood. Something's wrong. You know, you're communicating messages, you are communicating expectations, and until there's action, you can't assume anything other than the fact that people have been talking at each other, but maybe not communicating. And so that, to me, is just the aha moment, still at age 63, soon to be 64, that you constantly say, goodness gracious, this is much more complex than I ever realized.
Yeah, and I go through the same conversations with our students, teaching them business communications one and business communications two. You know, there are monologues where I'm talking and you're listening. There are dualogues where we're both talking and nobody's listening. And then there are dialogues where we seem to be communicating.
Yep.
You know, and it's interesting the differences between those and how people tend to mix those up.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think through your leadership legacy, what is Farrell Coppedge most proud of as a leader?
I think just to be trusted. I mean, I've been blessed to be a part of some things that, you know, when part of what we didn't talk about, I spent 28 years with Bank of America and legacy organizations and with Regions now working with a very good friend of mine in the building out of that platform. But I spent 28 years and really starting with a tiny little company that ultimately was acquired by Fleet that ended up being the platform for Bank of America's asset-based lending business when when Bank of America acquired it.
Okay.
And a lot of I worked with a guy, this guy I was telling you about earlier, that had the foresight and the self-awareness, kind of like a point guard. He could see the whole floor. He couldn't play all the positions, but he could see the whole floor. And this is a guy, when he retired, that would print out his email. His secretary would print out his email messages, and you know, because he didn't use a computer. But yet he, in the industry, was 10 years ahead of everybody else in terms of setting up a technology committee that recognized the value proposition of giving customers online access to their information so that they could interface. And really, it was a great labor-saving efficiency productivity measure on our part, but ultimately it enhanced the value proposition. It raised the switching costs, and it helped us grow a business that really should not have been bigger than Bank of America when it was acquired by Fleet.
Interesting.
So I look back at that, and, you know, again, I just learned a lot of this by in an organization we used to there were always books being handed out in our organization with the management team. We were always discussing management strategy. We had probably one of the best performance-based compensation systems with the most direct link between performance and pay 15 years before the – so, you know, a lot of this – but again, it was all built – you know, our culture was, you know, honesty, integrity, and true. You know, so, I mean, at the end of the day, if you don't get that right – so I've been a part of some things that really have been neat, that have just been a fascinating – the people I work with right now at Regions are fabulous. One of the guys that I work for, Rick Downey, is one of my dear friends and really an icon in the industry. And to be able to finish my career working side by side with someone that was a competitor,
mm-hmm.
And really became a dear friend as a competitor is great. And he and I share our philosophies align up very, very closely.
So you see that as one of the keys to being fulfilled in work, perhaps, is making sure that your philosophies and the way you see life and the things that you want to get accomplished in your career tend to line up?
Yeah, I mean, if they don't, then, you know, you've got you may internalize it, but if who you are and what you believe don't line up, that's a bad day.
Yeah.
I mean, that is that's not fun, and, you know, I'm happy. I sleep at night. And been able to practice a management style that I truly believe in, and I think works and has been successful. And, you know, fascinating business. The M&A business, the leveraged finance business, is fascinating, particularly if you are curious and you're inquisitive. You get to see every type of manager under the sun, every type of leader under the sun. You get to see people solve incredible challenges. I mean, you know, technology has been levered to such an incredible extent in our country. People just don't understand the power of middle market business. But just a quick snapshot, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, supply chains, your vendor was down the street.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't into really hyper management of your working capital and your inventory turns. You know, the inventory, you know, you turn your inventory two times a year. Now your vendor is in Asia. You are selling to a customer just in time, and your product that goes into the car is showing up on the manufacturing floor in the morning, and it's on a car. Now, the complexity of the supply chain alone is incredible. And then you add to that that these are not Americans you grew up with down
That's
the street.
Right.
These are all these things that we talked about. So business has gotten incredibly, infinitely more complex. Communications and the tools and really the aptitude of leaders. I mean, to the credit of KSU and others, I mean, there's a phenomenal group of talent that academia has produced that is going into a complicated business world today. It's never been more complicated,
mm-hmm.
and is performing incredibly well.
And helping to lead the pace on a global scale.
Yeah, absolutely.
In some areas, because we don't lead in all areas, right?
Yeah.
Which is important. So how important is it for employees, colleagues, and leadership to be lifelong learners?
Oh, it's an imperative. I mean, it's I think lifelong learners and lifelong workers. I'm one of these people that doesn't believe in retirement. I retired when I was 59 with a deer in headlights for 60, 90 days, didn't know what I was going to do, didn't need to necessarily work for a salary, but just, you know, that shock of what am I going to do for intellectual stuff? So I and part of that is just learning, growing. But I believe it's an absolute imperative. I think, you know, we're in a world today, unlike my father's world or even when I started out, where my job security is a function of my value proposition.
There you go.
I'm a value proposition. I'm an individual little P&L. And to what extent, you know, can I make the company I'm working for more profitable, more successful? Now, part of that is, you know, there's still a contract going on here and that I've got to give to you, but you've got to create an opportunity for me too. If you know, jobs are hard to come by now, and I'm feel terrible for those many people that are still out of work. But if you're in a job and you're not being stimulated and you're not being given the opportunity to learn, and that's by definition not a good job. And but a lot of it is just, I mean, access to information. There is no excuse now not to almost being a mini expert on everything.
Exactly.
So
the technology makes it so available.
Yeah.
I mean, podcasts like ours.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go. I mean, you can learn any subject under the sun podcasting, and it's typically free.
Yeah. The thing today is really having triaging. Really kind of where you spend your time. You've got to you really got to be intentional about how you spend your time, because there's so much out there. We can all develop ADD by just flitting on the surface of so many issues. It's easy to do that.
Right.
But
good point.
Couldn't agree with that perspective even anymore.
Very good point. So how important is it to have a great mentor? And can you give us maybe a few examples from your own development as a leader? You know, what were the significant influences for you, and who helped you to provide perspective on the way things were going and perhaps the foundational aspects of where you were headed?
Yeah. Mentors are an imperative. And, you know, when you go to work someplace, particularly in the earlier part of your career, you need to be intentional about finding those. And they typically just occur. Now, we've had formalized mentoring programs. And mentoring is so important. I mean, mentoring is where somebody, you know, that is more experienced just really has a desire to invest in you and to spend the time. Now, time is something none of us have enough of today. But if you find that person, they're going to find the time. It may be breakfast before work. It may be coffee. It may be whenever it's going to be, but a good mentor is going to be intentional about finding the time to help you, to be a resource for you. And mm-hmm. and I've had those throughout my business career, and not because of any formal matching up, although we do that,
right?
Because it's so important, and it's really important to help you understand emerging managers and emerging leaders, because I have never seen a leader emerge or a talented manager emerge that is not a mentor first. I mean, it's something they're drawn to, that connection to share, to invest. And so I really, in terms of creating formalized mentoring programs, we've done that just to see how some people, you know, sometimes you do that and nothing happens.
Correct.
There's never the first meeting.
Interesting.
But the mentoring is incredibly important. It helps, you know, individuals mature much, much quicker. And again, to get beyond the superficial and to really understand the nuance of business relationships, communication, whatever the topic is.
Well, great. Thank you for that. So what is Farrell Coppedge doing to ensure that he continues to grow and develop as a leader?
I read all the time. I read and I interact and I ask a lot of questions. I just, you know, again, that's who I am. I mean, if you go to the living room in our house, there are probably six or so. I have the tendency to read three or four books at a time about totally unrelated subjects, but I'm always reading.
Stimulating.
You know, nobody can ever take one of my books because they're all underlined, their notes and everything. You know, when you get to be my age, you don't remember, you know, what you had for breakfast. And so I don't necessarily retain any of what I read right now, but I read a lot. And I love to just interact with people. Love to understand what makes people tick, what motivates them. I love to, you know, to just across the board, you name a subject and let's talk about it.
Yeah, you've got some ideas and thoughts and certainly opinions on those, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So with that in mind, who's going to win the Final Four?
I think Louisville is destined to win it. What do you think?
I think you're exactly right. They've got the emotional impetus.
Yeah.
You know, with the gentleman that ended up with a compound fracture. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So with regard to what you do to recharge the batteries and to keep you sharp, innovative, and cutting edge, is it reading or is it some other things involving exercise? What do you do?
I think it's balance. I have a great family. I mean, I've had two knee operations and, you know, have kind of all the old war injuries and stuff. So
better to wear out than rust out.
No, exactly. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think just exercising, you know, just the orientation to it's, you know, my life is basically physical, spiritual, you know, the health part. You know, my faith is a big part of who I am and, you know, make no apologies about that. I mean, I think the balance, the balance between, you know, just making sure that you're giving back. I think it's important. And my wife is very much the same way too, but oftentimes, you know, there would be things outside of work that I would be committing to on the weekends, and it's like, goodness, you travel all the time, you're never here, you're too tired. No, that's my energy. My energy comes from the diversity of things you're involved in, and I can go from, you know, working on a building committee from doing deals, and I'm still working on the financial side of it, but it's totally different.
Ah.
And so I draw energy from the diversity of that experience. I do believe, you know, the physical part of it is real important. I don't care how old you get. I think, you know, you've got to kind of work exercise into your routine to some extent. I've never been big on quality vacations. And my wife keeps talking about, you know, we've been able to travel quite a bit. But I'm in Africa probably 3 times a year. And
wow.
So that's typically 10 days to 2 weeks of time. So when you know.
And then there's time on the back end when you come back, you have to reacclimate yourself
absolutely.
You know, to
but
America.
Yeah, but I'm good with the routine now. I've got that worked down. I can get back in gear within a couple of days.
Excellent. I think the world of M&A is fascinating, as no doubt you do. And I also think the two most important things we as leaders have a great degree of control over is the people we associate with and the resources we utilize.
Right.
And so with that in mind, I've certainly been enriched by spending a little quality time with you today. And because of one of the goals of our program is to pass along tips and advice from readers like you and leaders like you, I'd like to know which book has most impacted your leadership ability.
You know, this is going to sound trite. I mean, it's the Bible. I mean, we're in a world today where, you know, the word Christian is misused and misunderstood, and this is certainly not the forum for clarifying that. But it's amazing how many fundamental concepts there are about how you treat people and the consequences of that and the enduring consequences of that. You know, I have drawn a lot from that, and I've been amazed as I have studied management philosophy and motivational philosophy, how much of it literally you can trace back to that. You know, every contemporary management book out there, I can promise you I've read it. I can't promise you I can remember the titles of it, but it was required, and part of the reason I loved the job I had for so many years was that we were always reading and discussing strategy, motivation, management, even, you know, marketing strategies, growing and building a business. So you were just – I mean, I have boxes of books that I hope someday somebody wants that I just – you know, the boxes of books – and
they can take the books, but you've got the knowledge.
Well, I mean, I used to have a stack of Harvard Business Review articles that I would give new managers I hired, and one of them was written back in the 1980s. It's How to Manage Your Manager. Just a fundamental, you know, because a lot of people really don't understand what that dynamic is supposed to be like and how best to lever that relationship. So I have a stack of, boxes at Harvard Business Review. I used to subscribe to that just because of the wealth of information that was there, just always contemporary, always insightful, and,
So the book that has most impacted your leadership ability is?
Oh, it's the Bible.
The Bible. So, Farrell, on behalf of our learning community, I truly appreciate you accepting the invitation to join us today, no doubt. And I'd love to have you back on the show if we can work out that and sync up our calendars. Yeah. Is that a deal?
Yeah, you know everything I know now or know something about, so I don't know what we'll talk about. But anyway,
that's too funny.
It's been a pleasure. It's I was looking forward to this and enjoyed it.
Fantastic. So with that in mind, can you tell us how our learning community can contact you, either by email and or by phone?
Yeah. Email address is Farrell, and it's spelled F-E-R-R-E-L-L, period, Coppedge, C-O-P-P-E-D-G-E, at regions.com. And telephone number is 404-783-2895. And we'll be happy to talk to anybody that has any follow-up questions or would like to discuss anything.
Well, fantastic. So as a special thank you for you, I have a copy of Business Acumen 2, which is the insights from the faculty and friends of the Coles College of Business as our gift to you for appearing on our show today.
It's autographed by you, I hope. Well, I see it's not.
I will be in a minute here. I just want to make certain that that was what you really wanted. So with those smiles, we'll bring today's edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. So we invite all our listeners to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. So also, please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu if you have recommendations for guests. For those of you interested in our award-winning Executive MBA program, please go to the eMBA icon on our Global Leader Radio site to connect with us and sign up for an information session, which, by the way, is this coming Saturday. So join us again at this same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with passionate people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.